When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture. Luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Discuss, challenge, inform, comment, viewpoint on Talk Radio Europe.
Giles Brown.
Live comment and discussion with studio guests.
Viewpoint.
Always live, always lively. That's Viewpoint on TRA Talk Radio Europe's current affairs programme with the panel of guests where we discuss the issues of the day. 952 78 4000 is the phone number, studio at tre.radio, the email, the Facebook page, if you wish to leave a post or review, is Talk Radio Europe Official, and you can WhatsApp us on +34 645 99 67 95. Joined in the studio by Alex Rafaela and Alf Brewer. 952 78 4000. Let's go back to some of the emails we have. Starting off with looking, Richard is coming back with Alf. The referendum wasn't. This is talking about the leave or the Brexit referendum. The referendum wasn't legally binding at all. You can argue there's plenty of scope for argument about whether politicians should feel obliged to implement the result anyway. But it is definitely not legally binding, and therefore it is advisory. And think about who said that it wasn't advisory initially. John Redwood. If you look at the EU Referendum Act, which received royal assent just before Christmas of 2005, it set out the referendum rules, so could be expected to define the effect of a vote either way. Alas, it did not. It made no provision as to the referendum's legal effect. That is because, strictly speaking, it has no legal effect. It was purely advisory, and in law, the government could simply ignore the result. Also, the European Union Referendum Act of 2015 didn't say anything about implementing the result of the vote. He just promised there should be one. So that is coming in from Richard. We joined the EEC. This is from Julie. We joined the EEC in 73. There was a referendum on continued membership in 1975, but with you, Alf, on the 15-year rule. Ken in Wicklow says, why do people who left a country and live outside that country think they should have a say in running it? And on the emails, on a lighter note, I think, from Elizabeth, just a silly point, read the curtsy. There are at least three correct curtsies that should be used to British royals. The one Mrs. May used is correct for the head of the royal household. However, our Queen has stated that the deep curtsy may be modified by females of a more advanced age. So that's your curtsies there for you, Alex.
Thank you very much. I feel much better for that.
Right.
I think I might go and practice on my own.
I think you should perhaps have a wee YouTube channel for that, actually. But anyway, 952 78 4000 is the phone number. Studio at tre.radio is the email. The Facebook page, Talk Radio Official, and you can WhatsApp us on +34 645 99 67 95. Viewpoint with you for the next 50 minutes. Alf, you want to come back on some points?
People shouldn't keep misquoting, you know. I don't mind people challenging me. I don't mind people saying I'm wrong, you know, but you shouldn't misquote. And I'll tell you, because I was a union official dealing with the shipping industry when the British Navy decided to put three of its new frigates to a French shipyard. And because of the furore from the trade unions, that's when they had to find an alternative, and the alternative then became Southeast Asia. But we could have kept our own shipyards going. So it was a government decision. This is the British Navy. These contracts don't last a year or two. They're like 15, 20, 25 years. The lifetime, half a lifetime of a working person. And they gave it away. Whoever they gave it to, they gave it away. Based on cost. So it's cheaper, but just so that we...
Those were decisions of the Thatcher government. Those are the legacies of the Thatcher government. So when you say we gave the way to Europe, it's Thatcher didn't protect the industries that we're talking about.
Absolutely. I didn't say we gave them away.
Protected in America, it's the same thing. It's those monetary, ideological policies
Alex, stop misquoting. I didn't say she gave them away. I said we lost the industry because of government decisions. Government decide that they're not going to invest in the pharmaceutical industry. We lost pharmaceutical companies. We had an industry for agrochemicals in the UK that was the biggest in Europe. There's not one left now because they've closed them all down because Belgium and France offered an alternative in the EU. And so the British government can make this, and that was under a Blair government. So, I'm not into all this party politics. It's called the government. And I never also said anything about Cameron. This is what people have short memories. Cameron didn't get elected on the basis of I'm better than Brown. Cameron got elected on the basis that there was a lot of people who were joining UKIP, a lot of pressure from those people to say we've got to get out of Europe, a lot of people saying we don't like what's happening with immigration. Cameron made a promise in the Tory manifesto that he would abide by the outcome of a referendum. I never once said, and I ain't going to say, it's politically binding, it's legally binding, because it isn't, and it is an advisory. But when a government coming into power says, if this is the outcome, this is what we're going to do, the first people that will moan would be the people who say, well, we said that. And Farage, by the way, wasn't arguing about leaving. Farage's comments were quite clear. Farage had the view, and along with a lot of UKIP people, that because the vote was so close, the Tories would renege on pulling out of Europe. And that's when he said, this is unfinished business, because he was putting pressure on the government to keep them on track to say, we are leaving. Just remember, this isn't some tin pot organisation. Farage wasn't in charge of some little outfit. In the elections of that year, UKIP polled 3 million votes. They only got one seat in Parliament because of the first-past-the-post system, but they polled 3 million votes. Now, if people are going to try and tell me, they were all Tories, not true. They would come from everywhere because there were people who were protesting against being in Europe. That was the biggest claim. Even the immigration issue paled into insignificance when people were asked the question, do you want to stay in Europe or leave? It became an issue about the European Union. Now, Cameron has got to survive. The Tory party have got to survive. So Cameron on his own didn't make this decision. They'd have had their think tanks going. And they'd have been saying, what can we say to appease these UKIP voters to come and vote Tory? Simple as that. Or better still, what can we say to these people that will stop them being anti-us? Right, we'll give them what they want. We'll give them a referendum, and then we'll give them a vote, not a vote, and then we'll give them the promise that whatever the outcome of the referendum, that's what the government will abide by. And that's what the government did. And that's the legal decision, a government decision. They don't just sit in Parliament and make we'll just say this. It becomes law. It doesn't become a statute, but it becomes law. And if Parliament says we're leaving the EU, somebody somewhere, whatever general's office they do it from, says, right, now we've got to fill this paperwork in. We'll fill this, and as soon as we've put that in, that's the legal confirmation of Britain. And who signs it? Of course the Prime Minister signs it, but he's signing on behalf of the government. And whether you like it or not, that's what they did. So we get on with it. However, for Felix's point of view, I've always been a campaigner against what I don't believe in. It doesn't stop me campaigning to say Britain should change its opinion. It doesn't stop me. But I tell you what, before, it's not about having a second referendum. What you got to do is convince a Tory government to either put themselves up for election to see if they can win again, or have the decency and honesty to stand up and go, actually, we think this is wrong for Britain, and we're now going to retract from it. Because they could do that legally because they're the government, and then go to the people and say, do you think we did the right thing? It's called a general election.
The people never wanted the referendum. the people, the referendum, there has been a small right-wing anti-Europe element to the Conservative Party continually since the 1970s. Major had to fend them off. Thatcher dealt with them in a certain way. So basically what happened when the Conservatives won the election without the Liberal Democrats as their partners, when they fully won it for the first time, to keep Cameron in power, to stop him being removed by his own party, to keep the right wing dogs baying for the blood of Europe, which there has always been in the right wing of the Conservative Party, he agreed to put a referendum to the people. The people were not crying for a referendum. The people did not decide that they wanted a referendum. He did it to save his own skin in order to not to be ousted by his own party.
And we're going live to the lines. 952-78-4000. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Yeah, morning. Sharon Alicante.
Morning,
Sharon. I've got two articles, I think, because I do read all papers. I read the ones I don't like as well as the ones I like. So these are from the Express over a few weeks. I think one may have been from the Times, actually. One from the Times and one from the Express that said that various national governments over recent decades have sold off our fishing rights. And there was a little headline, a sub-headline, saying, thank you, Falklands, for nothing, basically, because the Falklands have said that if you want your fishing... This is the Falklands, not Europe. If you want your fishing rights back, you're going to have to buy them back. We're not actually really prepared to hand them back to you anyway. So it is national governments that have sold everything off that we've got. And I just find... I think Alex is correct that Europe is being used as a scapegoat. Thank you. Cheers.
And we're going to the other ones as well. Good morning, Corey, live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Good morning. It's Carol again from the Costa Blanca.
Yes, Carol.
I'm sorry, Al, for calling you Mr. Grumpy.
Don't worry.
I was given to believe, I may be totally wrong here, I've got 2 points. I may be totally wrong here, Alf, but the Liverpool was one of the greatest ports in Europe, if not the world. And because of the militant activities that were going on in Hatton and people like that, that were going on in Liverpool at the time, in the reign of Maggie Thatcher, they all moved to Rotterdam. All the big ships, all the big containers moved to Rotterdam. And it was actually the unions that ruined Liverpool docks. Well, obviously with the help of Maggie Thatcher, because they played into her hand. And the second thing, again, I may be totally wrong, but I believe the vote on Brexit was not necessarily the people voting, let's say, to leave Europe, but they were voting because they were fed up with the immigration that was going into the UK. And they were quoting all the time, I can remember, all the time prior to the vote, they were quoting all the time Enoch Powell with the Rivers of Blood. They were quoting that all the time, most people. And I think that was the thing that they were, in inverted commas, voting against.
Carol, thank you for your
Bye.
Calls in there. Plenty to think about there, Alf. The Liverpool dock closed down by a combination of Margaret Thatcher and Derek Hatton and militancy playing into her hands.
Well, Derek Hatton was just a local councillor. And, yeah, all right, he might have been involved in the local Labour Party, but that's all he was a local councillor. He did have control of Liverpool, but he would have had no say in what was happening with Liverpool docks. And the argument goes, if the dock owners, i.e. the people who the shipping lines and that, if they want to start on the workforce and treat them and abuse them, then quite right, the unions are going to get their own back. But that's not what happened with the docks in Britain. And we still have one of the world's biggest ports. It's called Harwich. And the issue about the docks, and I lived around the London Dockland area, well, most of my life, is because the docks are too shallow. You cannot get container ships into the docks. they would have had to rebuild East London effectively to get the ships in because of containerisation, not because of the ships. So instead of closing the docks, the East India, the West India, the Royals, instead of closing them, just which they did eventually, they built Tilbury. They built it as a deep water harbour that could handle a day turnaround of a container ship. And then after that, they decided, well, that's still a bit too close to London and we ain't got enough land. So they then started investing in Harwich and Folkestone and places up the coast. So, yeah, Rotterdam is probably the world's biggest, but it's the only one they've got. Mm. Whereas in Britain, we've got a number of them. You have to put them together. So the Liverpool docks was about containerisation, not about Smiley Face, who become a bigger Tory than I'm accused of now being. And it had very little to do with the unions. The unions, if you recall, it was called Stratford, and it was about stuffing and stripping containers. And who did that work? Was it dockers, or was it just Joe Bloggs, the labourer, who they could employ? And they built, you know, Chobham Farm and Chub Alley and whatever else was about stuffing and stripping containers, putting them on a lorry, driving them to a docks and putting them on a ship. And they, Stratford is less than 5 miles from the Royal Docks, but they couldn't drive the lorries there because they couldn't get the ships in there. So they'd stuff and strip, because that's where Stratford Marshalling Yard is, the biggest rail network in Europe. And they used to bring the stuff in on the trains, stuff the containers or strip the containers in warehousing on the side of the road, stick them on another container and drive them down to Tilbury to put on a ship to sail off somewhere. Quite often, that ship would sail to Rotterdam and drop off containers there, because the bigger worldwide carriers, the ones who you see that's like a block of flats on the sea, they could only get into Rotterdam because we hadn't built Harwich. So even Tilbury Dock wasn't, I think it wasn't wide enough. It might have been deep enough, but it wasn't wide enough to turn the container ships around, and it would have had to have meant building lock gates or some nonsense. And they decided not to do that, and they built Harwich instead. So, you know, the docks in Britain are massive. Seriously, man, a massive industry and employ thousands of people.
Richard's coming back on this point saying, no, the UK lost the industry due to competition. It was far cheaper to build ships in South Korea. The UK in 1986 went gung-ho on liberating the financial markets, hence why the UK is now 80% service-based. Harwich is tiny. It's not even a top three UK container point. Felixstowe is number one. And then if you want to get your top 10 of container ports, which I will do in a sort of, you know, top 10 sort of style, Rotterdam in at number 11, and at number one, Shanghai, number one container port globally.
And it may be, but that doesn't mean to say Britain hasn't got a docking industry. It has, but it changed, and it changed because of containerisation, not because of anything else. It was, you know, Fred Olsen Lines used to come into Canary Wharf, which is why it was called Canary Wharf, because they used to pick the tomatoes up from the Canary Islands. And that's where they delivered them to. So the Fred Olsen Line ships went from the Canary Islands to Canary Wharf, unloaded all their tomatoes, turned the ship round, put the passengers on, and went back to the Canary Islands.
Well, you see, we learn something every day.
Yeah, but then they stopped.
Yeah.
Why is that? Oh, because Fred Olsen Lines decided, you know, we could put the tomatoes in a container, and therefore we don't have to have 250 forklift trucks going in the side of a ship. We'll put them on containers and put them on the back of a passenger ship, what you think is a car ferry, and they put them in and they drop them off. I think they still drop them off at Tilbury, but they may have gone to Harwich. And Harwich may not be that big now. Just go and have a look at the plans. I worked down there for a while during a general election. And that was one of the boasts of the Labour candidate, that Britain was investing, a Labour government was investing in Harwich to make it as big as Rotterdam. Okay, so it's not the world's top one, but it's like, you know, big in the world.
Well, I'm glad we found out where Canary Wharf came from. I always thought Canary Wharf was named after the flocks of wild canaries that flew over from the Isle of Dogs, but there you go.
No, it's just full of flocks of wild bankers who were
and Canarian in Roman was dog. Right. So I understand. It's on the Isle of Dogs. You got stuff coming in from the Canary Islands. It was obvious they were going to call it Canary Wharf. And the only ships that went in there were Fred Olsen Line.
Back after this.
TRE, Talk Radio Europe. View
Viewpoint with Giles Brown.
Giles Brown here, live from the studios of TRE Talk Radio, your voice in Spain. Again, always lively, this Viewpoint with Alex Rafaela and Alf Brewer. 952-78-4000, the phone number, studio at TRE.radio is the email. The Facebook page, if you wish to leave a post or a comment, or a meme, I believe. Talk Radio Europe Official, should you feel so that way. And WhatsApp, +34 645 99 67 95. Email in here from Les saying, read the email you read out just now, which went along the lines of, why do people who leave their country of birth think they should be allowed to comment on the way how that country is run? Well, I have to say that one really winds me up. Regardless of where I live, I am still a British citizen. The decisions made in the UK will affect my life here in Spain in a major way. Moving to another country does not mean I've given up my nationality, and as long as I hold a British passport, I have every right to give my opinion on something as serious as Brexit and how it will affect my life. That's why. Going live to the lines, 952-78-4000. Good morning, caller, you're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
It's Paul from Costa Calida. I would just like to correct, we've been going on about Harwich being the premier port. The port of Harwich doesn't exist hardly now. I worked there for 25 years. My son still works on the dock. One time I employed 8,000 people. Now there's probably less than 350. The main port in the Harwich harbour is Felixstowe, not Harwich.
Okay, so I stand corrected.
Alf Mayer visited there. I know the Labour candidate who won the election there 3 years. It's just Henderson.
Yep.
He worked on the docks at the time.
Yep.
But it doesn't exist as a port now. It's got a couple of ferries to Hook of Holland, and maybe three or four container ships a week, and that's it.
So does that mean they've scrapped the plans for extending the docks?
Yes, they scrapped them because they didn't
Damaged the port, isn't it?
No, because we're going back now 25 years.
That's correct.
They promised a dual carriageway through all the way through from Colchester through to Harwich. That doesn't exist. That stops at Wicks.
It's
single lane. And it wasn't the Tory government that stopped the expansion. It was the Labour government.
I'm not into all this government.
That's why Ivan Henderson, who was a Labour MP at the time, had lots of discourse with the Labour Party because they didn't put any investment into it, despite the fact they promised they would do.
Yeah, absolutely. I went quite often with Ivan to argue the case for Harwich docks. Hang on, let me just finish because I'll make the point again. It's the government who makes these decisions that affect working lives. I'll just come back on a bit about the Falklands. As I understand it, the fishing rights of the Falklands, if Britain had gone carried on fishing the Falklands, like it could do some of its other old places, if it did that, it would be counted towards the quota for fishing for the UK. It defeats itself. You have a fishing fleet in the Falklands. Blimey, tell me that the Felixstowe fishermen would be really pleased about that.
No, but all of the private money that went into Felixstowe was not supported by the government. The infrastructure already existed from Ipswich through to Felixstowe with the dual carriageway.
Yeah.
The bridge over the Orwell was necessary anyway, and that was built regardless of Felixstowe on the A12. The A14.
This is all very interesting, but at the end of the day, the government made decisions. And whether you say it was private investment, the government still decided it needed to have another container dock. They invested in Harwich. Not the government, but people did.
My beef isn't about investment or anything like that. It's just that you say it quite clearly that Harwich is one of the senior ports in the UK.
Well, it was when I was there.
Harwich, I worked there for 25 years. It wasn't. It never has been.
Right. Thank you for the call in. Always good to know. Good to have you with us as well for that one. We now know more about ports and containers than I ever did at the beginning of this show. So thank you for your call in.
Thank you. Bye.
952-78-4000, the phone number, studio at tre.radio is the email. The Facebook page, Talk Radio Official, and you can WhatsApp us on +34 645 99 67 95. Now, getting away from that, since we were last on air last last Tuesday, images of Jeremy Corbyn seeming to be at a wreath-laying ceremony for Palestinian terrorists who were responsible or took part in the massacre of Israeli athletes in the 1972 Olympic Games. Jeremy Corbyn came back saying he was in the cemetery. There was a ceremony going on at the time, but he wasn't aware of the context of the wreath-laying ceremony. Is this just right-wing media picking up and doing a spot of Corbyn bashing, Alex?
A classic smear campaign, Giles. I think if you once again diversionary tactics from the fact that we have a top-ranking Tory government, ex-government official who is now making a bid to be the next leader of the Tory Party, insulting a swathe of the British populace, inciting rabid Islamophobia. Islamophobic attacks have been on the rise since Boris has been talking of his since Boris actually met Steve Bannon, who masterminded Trump's campaign, and yet all the British media is focusing on is Corbyn laying a wreath. If you see all of the tactics being employed, it is a classic smear campaign, and I think one of the most possibly a great PR coup. So I'm going to use an example here. If I was sitting in Spain. Spain is a Christian country, and I said, oh, I don't like what the Spanish government are doing. It's hideous. Am I being anti-Christian? No, I'm criticising a government.
Yes.
And I think what has happened is I have a strange background. I'm half my family are Egyptian and half my family are Russian Jewish. So I've had a particular viewpoint on both sides of the fence. And what has happened now is a mastermind of PR by the government. I'm saying the government, the force of government that rules a country in it, the Israeli government, which has nothing to do with the race of people or the religion. It is a government. But what has now happened is any criticism of the government of that country has now been manipulated into being anti-Semitic. So one cannot criticize a government without now being smeared as being an anti-Semite. And if you see the uproar that is going on, for anybody now who criticizes the Israeli government is now being labeled anti-Semitic, which is ultimately quite ridiculous, because what they're criticising is the government. They're not criticising the race or the religion.
But Corbyn was photographed at this laying of a wreath. He was standing there by the wreath in Tunisia. He's come back saying we were against the victims of all terrorism. Surely he should have better advisers than this, or is he trying to pull a fast one?
Absolutely, and that's the crux of this is, I don't know, because I haven't been around the inner workings of the party for a fair while. But, he's got his advisors there. He's got people who are telling him what he can. They would never tell him to not have this photograph taken. It was probably taken. Who knows when it was taken? But, Jeremy Corbyn was known for his involvement with Palestinians, the IRA, and with lots of other, the Kurds. And he was known to be involved with all of these before he was ever elected as the leader of the Labour Party. So the people who were voting for him knew. The fact that I don't want him, the fact that it's coming... And what's brought it to a head is that someone's picked an issue, anti-Semitism, because something happened inside the Labour Party and he never handled it very well. And the criticism of Corbyn is you and the NEC and all your advisers have not handled this issue very well. Standing in front of a wreath is, that's where the media then gets involved. They didn't come from a government source. They didn't come from a Labour Party source. That was the media going, oh, what have we got on him? I'm not being funny, but they could have probably found all number of photographs. He shared a platform with the IRA on one occasion. What he can't do is he can't say, I don't support them. What he can say is, quite legitimately, I don't support the violence. I don't support this. I think these people are being downtrodden. Therefore, I'm going to be on their side to see if we can get a better solution. Anybody who says, you know, I said it on the programme a couple of weeks ago, at one stage I was a part of Labour friends of Israel, Labour friends of Palestine, because the issue is about the people, not about the politics. So the media wants to do it right. So a bunch of people inside the Labour Party don't want Corbyn as the leader. They've found an issue that it can attack him and undermine him because they believe that he's not very good at handling these sorts of issues. And I think he's just proved that. Then what happens is the media then jumps on, and boy, do they do a job. Yeah, and they'll keep on. Whether it's as a flanker for the Boris Johnson stuff, yeah, I've never been I've got a conspiracy theorist sitting next to me, but I've never believed in that. I Johnson's going for the leadership. He pulled out of the thing. But we said this, yeah, ages ago, didn't we, Giles? When they first put him in as foreign secretary, he ain't going to last in there, because if they think they're going to gag him, you know, that's not Boris Johnson. So, you know, he's freed himself. And he was always going to be, after the Gove nonsense of last time, he was always going to put himself into that, this time I'm unassailable. I am going to be the first choice when May goes. The subtle difference now is that where I think he is wrong is I think it's quite obvious that he's trying to undermine May to get rid of her so that he can get in quicker.
I'm going live to the lines. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please? Oh, and as my Welsh grandmother used to say, and there he was gone. Margaret Hodge came back this week as well, saying that that her treatment was anti-Semitic. Now, this is a woman who's been involved with the Labour Party, who's gone on record today as saying, earlier on, saying that the issue goes to the heart of who she was and the values that define my politics. I will fight to return Labour to the values that made me join it 55 years ago, Alf. I mean, surely if you've got somebody like Dame Margaret Hodge coming back and saying, you know, we're not happy with the way the party's going, they should be sitting up and taking notice.
Yeah, it depends on which way it's coming from. So Jeremy Corbyn's advisors should be telling him, which is why I think he finds himself in a dilemma, is that he's got to stop doing some of the things that he's been used to doing and stop saying some of the things that he used to say in order to become more electable to Joe Public. So he's doing things against him. So then along comes Margaret Hodge, who's always will be part of the group that I come from, which would always be in opposition to Jeremy Corbyn. And she's, you know, quite rightly saying, the way you're treating me is wrong, because it's called anybody, me on the radio, I could say something in all innocence because I've got an opinion. Somebody back at Labour Party head office, I'm not saying that they listen to Talk Radio Europe, but somebody there could get wind by whatever method, and all of a sudden Alf Brewer's there being disciplined for being either anti-Semitic or anti-leader or anti-Labour, whatever, which is never further from the truth. And she has been a party member for a little bit longer than me. I've known Margaret Hodge for a long time. She's a genuine MP in the House of Commons. I think that's about as far as I better go.
Going live to the lines. Good morning, Cooley, live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Hi, Felix again.
Morning, Felix.
I was listening to Alfser and points that Corbyn has always been associated with the Irish Sinn Féin Adams and also with the Palestinian Arabs. For a very, very long time, I mean, I'm talking about 40 or 50 years, I agree so much with Alf, you know, on that question. So why would he be expected to change now? Fair play to you, Alf, on that. The issue that Alex raised is the issue I want to take up, because, I mean, I'm a lover of the Jewish people, although Irish, non-Jewish, Catholic, you know, Catholic background. Very anti-Semitic country, in my opinion, historically, you know. I am also a great supporter of Zionism, and I am left-wing, as left-wing, Alf will tell you, as left-wing as you can get. So I'm a total exception there. The reason I want to take up Alex, you know, gently, because this is very his position is very common, is Israel. Israel is a very historical thing. It is the homeland of the Jewish people. The Jewish people have looked forward ever since their expulsion by the Romans to a return to the ancient homeland. And this is a fact. You know, it's proven by history, by contemporaries, by archaeology. And the Jewish people were flogged around the world from post, pillar to post, by anti-Semitism, not least in Russia. And the longing was always to return to the homeland, the hills of Judea, etc. And the situation in Israel is that all Jews, I would say 95% of Jews, look to Israel as the homeland of the Jewish people. And to suggest in any way that, that Israel is not the homeland of the Jewish people, or that this is not, or that Zionism is not the wish of the Jewish people to return to that homeland, is really the new anti-Semitism. It is where Holocaust denial is not acceptable, so they invent the new anti-Semitism. Thanks, Giles.
Bye. Thank you for your points, Felix. Good points, well made. Alex, do you want to come back on any of those points? We've got another call on the line as well.
I think also we are living in the land of Sephardi. There are Ashkenazi Jews and Sephardi Jews, and Sephardi Jews in the language of Ladino, which was the ancient Sephardic language, meant Spain. When you look at the ancient culture of Spain, when Spain was an Islamic country for over 1,000 years, it was the greatest point of harmony between the Muslim, the Jew, and the Christian. I think this, yes, in the same way that after the first expulsion from the Holy Land in the by the Babylonians, nonetheless, the Jewish people have always looked to Israel as the homeland, and I agree with that 100%. I would never doubt that. I also come from an Ashkenazi bloodline myself. But I'm very interested in is how governments, which governments are separate from the people, how governments manipulate situations in order to further their own governmental ideologies. And that's what my concern is, how the act of government, criticizing the act of government, has become something which has been manipulated into something far more emotive than it should be.
Going live to the lines. Good morning. Call you live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Oh. Mr. Banker.
Yes, Kate. Sorry. You go, yes.
The business of the anti-Semitism, rabbits thrown into the thing to take off attention elsewhere, is because it is divisive. The NEC came out with a definition that left off two or three sub-points of the 10 points or whatever. And it was an NEC decision, as I understand it. And the decision, the things that they left out were bits which would exclude any criticism of the Israeli government's actions. Now, Israeli government is not written in pillars of stone. And this is the kind of issue that has been hyped up enormously. For example, you could be criticizing very fairly the Israelis' continued involvement in pushing settlements. The original Balfour thing said they were supported a homeland for the Jews as long as it didn't adversely affect any of the people living there at the time. Well, that's the point of the sympathy for the Palestinians.
Thank you for your call. And going right to another line there, 952-78-4000. Good morning, caller, you're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Hello, Giles, it's Jason again.
Yes, Jason.
A bit of a history lesson here. The West is very culpable in many things, not in Iran. The Americans went in there in the 40s, didn't the puppet dictators have been there ever since? We reap what we sow. Also, in the end of during the First World War, we were losing, and the Arabs were persuaded to help us, and they were promised like a free state. He promised the same free state to Israel. Now, the Israeli argument was less strong, but it was better voiced. Unfortunately, the better argument, which was from the Arabs, we relinquished on our agreement. We set up there was a French colony set up, and a British quarter, and we totally betrayed the Muslims or the Arabs, and then Israel came to be. I'm sure Felix knows more about this than me, but that's all I want to say.
Jason, thank you for your call in there on 952 784 1000.
Just so we don't lose some of the points, some of the issues about Felix. Felix asked a direct question. Why would Corbyn change after all this number of years? I think he's been a party member for about 45, about the same time as me. And why should he change? Well, that's because he's now the leader of the opposition. When you're not in power, you can always be an oppositionist. Jeremy Corbyn has spent all of his political life in opposition. Even when there was a Labour government, he was in opposition to the government. So when you spent all that time, yeah, it's difficult to change. But now your advisers are saying, this is what we need to do in order to get elected. And there are issues that, you know, for instance, why aren't Labour coming out and being anti-Brexit? Why aren't they? Well, because they know loads of Labour Party voters voted to leave Europe. So you can't come out as a... That causes him a dilemma. I would imagine that the Labour Party split about the same as the country split. So he's got a dilemma, because he can't come out and say, well, I'm this. I would imagine... I don't think he wanted to go into Europe. I don't think he's ever liked being in Europe. And I think he would be a Brexiteer. But he can't come out and say that, because he'd never get elected, because half the Labour supporters that are there would not vote for him. The same thing with the anti-Semite stuff. Yeah, an issue comes up that he can't deal with, because, and I say this in all politeness, he has spent all his life, and I didn't say supported the IRA, I said he shared platforms with these people, and he was always opposed to the terrorism. He was also always opposed to the shootings and the wars and all that. He was always opposed to that. I would never ever have a thing said about it. He never came out and said, I support the IRA. What he did do was supported the cause that the IRA had about bettering the lives of people in Ireland. That doesn't make him an IRA supporter. That means he supports the people who are doing it. And when, you know, people want to nitpick at everything, you know, Kate, yes, it was an NEC decision, because that's how the rules of the Labour Party work. That decision, if you're in any organisation, somebody's given the task of doing some work and they put a recommendation. The recommendation was put to the NEC and the NEC agreed with it. I don't think the NEC had the information or the wherewithal to vote against it, because, to be honest, they're all there trying to get Corbyn and trying to, you know, not kill off the issue, but deal with the anti-Semitism in the Labour Party that does exist. The same as there's racism that exists, the same as there's still sexual discrimination exists. You know, you just have to see the number of non-women MPs that Labour could have changed, to know that the Labour Party has this continuing development of dilemma. And him in particular, Jeremy Corbyn in particular, has got it really bad. So you can't say, oh, it was an NEC decision. It was made on a recommendation. And the recommendation was, it was 10 words of the original international thing. It's 10 words. It's not one of the points. It's 10 words that was explaining the type of thing you couldn't say about Israel. And everybody goes, well, why? You know, if I want to criticise the Israeli government because it's shooting people in the Gaza Strip, I think I'm entitled to do that. And that's got nothing to do with being anti-Semitic at all. That's called, I don't believe in you shooting people.
Viewpoint on Talk Radio Europe with Giles Brown.
Listen to Viewpoint Talk Radio Europe's always live, always lively current affairs programme. We discuss the issues of the day with a panel of invited guests even. Joined in the studio by Alex Rafaela and Alf Brewer. We go live to the lines 952-78-4000. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Hello, it's Alan. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine, Alan.
Okay. Many years ago, 1969 and the early 70s, often I used to have my breakfast with a couple of Jewish gentlemen that had actually survived the camps.
Right.
And they were the two of the nicest men you could have ever met. But they told me all them years ago, obviously, you need an Israel, which everybody agrees with. But they told me then that they didn't like the way Israel was going. You know, all them years ago.
Right.
And also, you never hear about the Israelis that are kicking all the Filipinos out. Filipinos that have been born there. They're 14 years old. They speak Hebrew. And that never comes to light. Anyway, on that note, I'll disappear.
Ara, okay. Thanks for that. Enjoy your breakfast.
And
you.
Bye.
952-78-4000, the phone number, studio at tre.radio, the email, the Facebook page, Talk Radio Europe Official, and you can leave us a post on, you can WhatsApp me on +34 645 99 67 95. Don't forget that Stephen Ritson is up after this.
Europe Today.
Miguel in Orihuela, south of the Costa Blanca. He said, did you say Gibraltar in the south of Spain? Smiley face, not so smiley, shock, horror.
Stephen Ritson.
No, I didn't. Yesterday, I remember specifically what I said. I said the temperatures in Gibraltar and the south of Spain, I said. Not Gibraltar in the south of Spain. Gibraltar and the south.
Reporting from across the region and the world.
Weekdays
from midday.
I like pedantry on this programme.
That's Europe Today following this programme. Right, almost out of time. It has been a pleasure and privilege to have another live and lively viewpoint. Thank you so much for all the emails and, of course, the telephone calls and the WhatsApp and the Facebook posts. Always good to hear from my panel of invited guests, and a special thank you to Alf Brewer. Any final thoughts, Alf?
Yeah, I really am not Mr. Grumpy. Thank you again for a good show.
I think that Michael Senker might be a little
Absolutely.
Thing. That somebody had stolen his crown for grumpiness.
I'll email him now with another grumpy story.
Indeed, absolutely. And first time contestant, as they say on other radio shows or whatever, but first time for Alex. Rafaela, Alex.
Well, first time contestant indeed, Giles. Well, as you know, I've been coming to this part of the world for many years. And I look at Andalusia, San Pedro, I look at it almost like a pina colada. It's not just a drink, it's a way of life. Thank you so much, Giles. It's been wonderful.
I'm glad it's been a particularly satisfying pina colada. This show will be repeated at 6 o'clock, of course. Once again, thanks for all the calls in. Don't forget, lots of great stuff coming up today on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. I will be back on Friday with its GB, not GQ, from 4 until 6. Have a great rest of your Tuesday, wherever you're listening. And thank you once again for the phone calls. I'm back on Friday. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. Stephen Ritson. Up next.
Views expressed on Viewpoint by invited studio guests and callers do not constitute an opinion endorsed in any way by Talk Radio Europe.